Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Hercules and the Space Gods, I'm proud to announce the Urantia Book Holiday Special with Nick Curto. Greetings and welcome, Nick. How are you today?
Oh, very, very good. It's really a cold one out there tonight. It's 17 degrees in New York City right now. And the weather man says it feels more like 6 degrees out there. So it is indeed a very, very good night to stay snug inside and keep warm and listen to our holiday program this evening, December 24th, 2021. I'm so glad that everyone can be here tonight to join us.
I'm glad, too, that we were able to pull this together, and I'm looking forward to learning more about the Urantia book.
All right. Well, we have indeed a very special holiday program tonight on this, the night before Christmas, Christmas Eve. The Urantia book provides an account of the days leading up to the birth of Jesus, as well as the birth of Jesus itself, and then what happens in the days, weeks that followed. It is a deeply, deeply detailed account that is unmatched anywhere. Tonight, our listeners will be listening to the actual written words of the Urantia book, fully describing the times, the people, the challenges, and the many joys as Mary and Joseph set on their trip by foot and with only one little donkey to have Mary ride on, and with their provisions that she has packed to sustain them on their way to Bethlehem for the Roman government mandated citizen census. And while Mary is also pregnant and almost ready to give birth to their baby, there is some very surprising facts in this account that are not found anywhere else. It is an unforgettable part of the Urantia book that is indeed the fifth epical revelation to our planet. Incidentally, the entire Urantia book may be read and listened to, yes, listened to, on the Urantia Book Fellowship website. And I'm going to provide you with that website address so that all our listeners may listen to that at a later date when they have some time. It's an amazing, amazing find. So I'm going to give it to you right now. So if you will please get a pen and a piece of paper. The website is www.urantiabook.org. I'm going to repeat that for you one more time. www.urantia. Now, what we're going to now listen to is part four of the Urantia book. Urantia book is in four parts, the last part, four part, and the title of that section is called The Life and Teachings of Jesus. It's paper 122, Birth and Infancy of Jesus. So, Hercules, if you will, please
sure.
Play the recording.
Okay.
Paper 122, Birth and Infancy of Jesus. It will hardly be possible fully to explain the many reasons which led to the selection of Palestine as the land for Michael's bestowal, and especially as to just why the family of Joseph and Mary should have been chosen as the immediate setting for the appearance of this Son of God on Urantia. After a study of the special report on the status of segregated worlds prepared by the Melchizedeks in council with Gabriel, Michael finally chose Urantia as the planet whereon to enact his final bestowal. Subsequent to this decision, Gabriel made a personal visit to Urantia, and, as a result of his study of human groups and his survey of the spiritual, intellectual, racial, and geographic features of the world and its peoples, he decided that the Hebrews possessed those relative advantages which warranted their selection as the bestowal race. Upon Michael's approval of this decision, Gabriel appointed and dispatched to Urantia the Family Commission of 12, selected from among the higher orders of universe personalities, which was entrusted with the task of making an investigation of Jewish family life. When this commission ended its labors, Gabriel was present on Urantia and received the report nominating three prospective unions as being, in the opinion of the commission, equally favorable as bestowal families for Michael's projected incarnation. From the three couples nominated, Gabriel made the personal choice of Joseph and Mary, subsequently making his personal appearance to Mary, at which time he imparted to her the glad tidings that she had been selected to become the earth mother of the bestowal child. 1. Joseph and Mary. Joseph, the human father of Jesus, Joshua ben Joseph, was a Hebrew of the Hebrews, albeit he carried many non-Jewish racial strains which had been added to his ancestral tree from time to time by the female lines of his progenitors. The ancestry of the father of Jesus went back to the days of Abraham, and through this venerable patriarch to the earlier lines of inheritance leading to the Sumerians and Nodites, and, through the southern tribes of the ancient Blue Man, to Andon and Fanta. David and Solomon were not in the direct line of Joseph's ancestry, neither did Joseph's lineage go directly back to Adam. Joseph's immediate ancestors were mechanics, builders, carpenters, masons, and smiths. Joseph himself was a carpenter and later a contractor. His family belonged to a long and illustrious line of the nobility of the common people, accentuated ever and anon by the appearance of unusual individuals who had distinguished themselves in connection with the evolution of religion on Urantia. Mary, the Earth Mother of Jesus, was a descendant of a long line of unique ancestors embracing many of the most remarkable women in the racial history of Urantia, although Mary was an average woman of her day and generation, possessing a fairly normal temperament. She reckoned among her ancestors such well-known women as Anon, Tamar, Ruth, Bathsheba, Ansi, Chloe, Eve, Enta, and Ratta. No Jewish woman of that day had a more illustrious lineage of common progenitors or one extending back to more auspicious beginnings. Mary's ancestry, like Joseph's, was characterized by the predominance of strong but average individuals, relieved now and then by numerous outstanding personalities in the march of civilization and the progressive evolution of religion. Racially considered, it is hardly proper to regard Mary as a Jewess. In culture and belief she was a Jew, but in hereditary endowment she was more a composite of Syrian, Hittite, Phoenician, Greek, and Egyptian stocks, her racial inheritance being more general than that of Joseph. Of all couples living in Palestine at about the time of Michael's projected bestowal, Joseph and Mary possessed the most ideal combination of widespread racial connections and superior average of personality endowments. It was the plan of Michael to appear on earth as an average man, that the common people might understand him and receive him. Wherefore Gabriel selected just such persons as Joseph and Mary to become the bestowal parents. 2. Gabriel appears to Elizabeth. Jesus' life work on Urantia was really begun by John the Baptist. Zacharias, John's father, belonged to the Jewish priesthood, while his mother, Elizabeth, was a member of the more prosperous branch of the same large family group to which Mary, the mother of Jesus, also belonged. Zacharias and Elizabeth, though they had been married many years, were childless. It was late in the month of June 8 B.C., about 3 months after the marriage of Joseph and Mary, that Gabriel appeared to Elizabeth at noontide one day, just as he later made his presence known to Mary. Said Gabriel, "While your husband Zacharias stands before the altar in Jerusalem, and while the assembled people pray for the coming of a deliverer, I, Gabriel, have come to announce that you will shortly bear a son who shall be the forerunner of this divine teacher, and you shall call your son John. He will grow up dedicated to the Lord your God. And when he has come to full years, he will gladden your heart, because he will turn many souls to God. And he will also proclaim the coming of the soul healer of your people, and the spirit liberator of all mankind. Your kinswoman Mary shall be the mother of this child of promise, and I will also appear to her." This vision greatly frightened Elizabeth. After Gabriel's departure, she turned this experience over in her mind, long pondering the sayings of the majestic visitor, but did not speak of this revelation to anyone save her husband until her subsequent visit with Mary in early February of the following year. For 5 months, however, Elizabeth withheld her secret even from her husband. Upon her disclosure of the story of Gabriel's visit, Zacharias was very skeptical, and for weeks doubted the entire experience, only consenting half-heartedly to believe in Gabriel's visit to his wife when he could no longer question that she was expectant with child. Zacharias was very much perplexed regarding the prospective motherhood of Elizabeth, but he did not doubt the integrity of his wife, notwithstanding his own advanced age. It was not until about 6 weeks before John's birth that Zacharias, as the result of an impressive dream, became fully convinced that Elizabeth was to become the mother of a son of destiny, one who was to prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah. Gabriel appeared to Mary about the middle of November, 8 BC, while she was at work in her Nazareth home. Later on, after Mary knew without doubt that she was to become a mother, she persuaded Joseph to let her journey to the city of Judah, 4 miles west of Jerusalem, in the hills, to visit Elizabeth. Gabriel had informed each of these mothers-to-be of his appearance to the other. Naturally, they were anxious to get together, compare experiences, and talk over the probable futures of their sons. Mary remained with her distant cousin for 3 weeks. Elizabeth did much to strengthen Mary's faith in the vision of Gabriel, so that she returned home more fully dedicated to the call to mother the child of destiny, whom she was so soon to present to the world as a helpless babe, an average and normal infant of the realm. John was born in the city of Judah, March 25, 7 BC. Zacharias and Elizabeth rejoiced greatly in the realization that a son had come to them as Gabriel had promised, and when on the 8th day they presented the child for circumcision, they formally christened him John, as they had been directed aforetime. Already had a nephew of Zacharias departed for Nazareth, carrying the message of Elizabeth to Mary, proclaiming that a son had been born to her, and that his name was to be John. From his earliest infancy, John was judiciously impressed by his parents with the idea that he was to grow up to become a spiritual leader and religious teacher. And the soil of John's heart was ever responsive to the sowing of such suggestive seeds. Even as a child, he was found frequently at the temple during the seasons of his father's service, and he was tremendously impressed with the significance of all that he saw. 3. Gabriel's announcement to Mary. One evening about sundown, before Joseph had returned home, Gabriel appeared to Mary by the side of a low stone table, and, after she had recovered her composure, said, "I come at the bidding of one who is my master, and whom you shall love and nurture. To you, Mary, I bring glad tidings when I announce that the conception within you is ordained by heaven, and that in due time you will become the mother of a son. You shall call him Joshua, and he shall inaugurate the kingdom of heaven on earth and among men. Speak not of this matter save to Joseph and to Elizabeth, your kinswoman, to whom I have also appeared, and who shall presently also bear a son, whose name shall be John, and who will prepare the way for the message of deliverance which your son shall proclaim to men with great power and deep conviction. And doubt not my word, Mary, for this home has been chosen as the mortal habitat of the child of destiny. My benediction rests upon you, the power of the Most High will strengthen you, and the Lord of all the earth shall overshadow you." Mary pondered this visitation secretly in her heart for many weeks until of a certainty she knew she was with child, before she dared to disclose these unusual events to her husband. When Joseph heard about all this, although he had a great confidence in Mary, he was much troubled and could not sleep for many nights. At first Joseph had doubts about the Gabriel visitation. Then, when he became well-nigh persuaded that Mary had really heard the voice and beheld the form of the divine messenger, he was torn in mind as he pondered how such things could be. How could the offspring of human beings be a child of destiny? Never could Joseph reconcile these conflicting ideas until, after several weeks of thought, both he and Mary reached the conclusion that they had been chosen to become the parents of the Messiah, though it had hardly been the Jewish concept that the expected deliverer was to be of divine nature. Upon arriving at this momentous conclusion, Mary hastened to depart for a visit with Elizabeth. Upon her return, Mary went to visit her parents, Joachim, and Hannah. Her two brothers and two sisters, as well as her parents, were always very skeptical about the divine mission of Jesus, though, of course, at this time they knew nothing of the Gabriel visitation. But Mary did confide to her sister Salome that she thought her son was destined to become a great teacher. Gabriel's announcement to Mary was made the day following the conception of Jesus, and was the only event of supernatural occurrence connected with her entire experience of carrying and bearing the child of promise. 4. Joseph's dream. Joseph did not become reconciled to the idea that Mary was to become the mother of an extraordinary child until after he had experienced a very impressive dream. In this dream, a brilliant celestial messenger appeared to him, and, among other things, said, "Joseph, I appear by command of him who now reigns on high, and I am directed to instruct you concerning the son whom Mary shall bear, and who shall become a great light in the world. In him will be life, and his life shall become the light of mankind. He shall first come to his own people, but they will hardly receive him. But to as many as shall receive him, to them he will reveal that they are the children of God." After this experience, Joseph never again wholly doubted Mary's story of Gabriel's visit and of the promise that the unborn child was to become a divine messenger to the world. In all these visitations, nothing was said about the house of David. Nothing was ever intimated about Jesus' becoming a deliverer of the Jews, not even that he was to be the long-expected Messiah. Jesus was not such a Messiah as the Jews had anticipated, but he was the world's deliverer. His mission was to all races and peoples, not to any one group. Joseph was not of the line of King David. Mary had more of the Davidic ancestry than Joseph. True, Joseph did go to the city of David, Bethlehem, to be registered for the Roman census, but that was because, 6 generations previously, Joseph's paternal ancestor of that generation, being an orphan, was adopted by one Zadok, who was a direct descendant of David. Hence was Joseph also accounted as of the house of David. Most of the so-called messianic prophecies of the Old Testament were made to apply to Jesus long after his life had been lived on earth. For centuries, the Hebrew prophets had proclaimed the coming of a deliverer, and these promises had been construed by successive generations as referring to a new Jewish ruler who would sit upon the throne of David, and, by the reputed miraculous methods of Moses, proceed to establish the Jews in Palestine as a powerful nation, free from all foreign domination. Again, many figurative passages found throughout the Hebrew Scriptures were subsequently misapplied to the life mission of Jesus. Many Old Testament sayings were so distorted as to appear to fit some episode of the Master's earth life. Jesus himself one time publicly denied any connection with the royal house of David. Even the passage, "A maiden shall bear a son," was made to read, "A virgin shall bear a son." This was also true of the many genealogies of both Joseph and Mary, which were constructed subsequent to Michael's career on earth. Many of these lineages contain much of the Master's ancestry, but on the whole they are not genuine and may not be depended upon as factual. The early followers of Jesus all too often succumbed to the temptation to make all the olden prophetic utterances appear to find fulfillment in the life of their Lord and Master. 5. Jesus's earth parents. Joseph was a mild-mannered man, extremely conscientious, and in every way faithful to the religious conventions and practices of his people. He talked little, but thought much. The sorry plight of the Jewish people caused Joseph much sadness. As a youth, among his 8 brothers and sisters, he had been more cheerful, but in the earlier years of married life, during Jesus's childhood, he was subject to periods of mild spiritual discouragement. These temperamental manifestations were greatly improved just before his untimely death and after the economic condition of his family had been enhanced by his advancement from the rank of carpenter to the role of a prosperous contractor. Mary's temperament was quite opposite to that of her husband. She was usually cheerful, was very rarely downcast, and possessed an ever sunny disposition. Mary indulged in free and frequent expression of her emotional feelings, and was never observed to be sorrowful until after the sudden death of Joseph. and she had hardly recovered from this shock when she had thrust upon her the anxieties and questionings aroused by the extraordinary career of her eldest son, which was so rapidly unfolding before her astonished gaze. But throughout all this unusual experience, Mary was composed, courageous, and fairly wise in her relationship with her strange and little understood firstborn son and his surviving brothers and sisters. Jesus derived much of his unusual gentleness and marvelous sympathetic understanding of human nature from his Father. He inherited his gift as a great teacher and his tremendous capacity for righteous indignation from his mother. In emotional reactions to his adult life environment, Jesus was at one time like his father, meditative and worshipful, sometimes characterized by apparent sadness, but more often he drove forward in the manner of his mother's optimistic and determined disposition. All in all, Mary's temperament tended to dominate the career of the divine son as he grew up and swung into the momentous strides of his adult life. In some particulars, Jesus was a blending of his parents' traits. In other respects, he exhibited the traits of one in contrast with those of the other. From Joseph, Jesus secured his strict training in the usages of the Jewish ceremonials and his unusual acquaintance with the Hebrew Scriptures. From Mary, he derived a broader viewpoint of religious life and a more liberal concept of personal spiritual freedom. The families of both Joseph and Mary were well educated for their time. Joseph and Mary were educated far above the average for their day and station in life. He was a thinker, she was a planner, expert in adaptation and practical in immediate execution. Joseph was a black-eyed brunette, Mary a brown-eyed, well-nigh blonde type. Had Joseph lived, he undoubtedly would have become a firm believer in the divine mission of his eldest son. Mary alternated between believing and doubting, being greatly influenced by the position taken by her other children and by her friends and relatives, but always was she steadied in her final attitude by the memory of Gabriel's appearance to her immediately after the child was conceived. Mary was an expert weaver, and more than averagely skilled in most of the household arts of the day. She was a good housekeeper and a superior homemaker. Both Joseph and Mary were good teachers, and they saw to it that their children were well-versed in the learning of that day. When Joseph was a young man, he was employed by Mary's father in the work of building an addition to his house, and it was when Mary brought Joseph a cup of water during a noontime meal that the courtship of the pair who were destined to become the parents of Jesus really began. Joseph and Mary were married in accordance with Jewish custom at Mary's home in the environs of Nazareth, when Joseph was 21 years old. This marriage concluded a normal courtship of almost 2 years' duration. Shortly thereafter, they moved into their new home in Nazareth, which had been built by Joseph with the assistance of two of his brothers. The house was located near the foot of the nearby elevated land, which so charmingly overlooked the surrounding countryside. In this home, especially prepared, these young and expectant parents had thought to welcome the child of promise, little realizing that this momentous event of a universe was to transpire while they would be absent from home in Bethlehem of Judea. The larger part of Joseph's family became believers in the teachings of Jesus, but very few of Mary's people ever believed in him until after he had departed from this world. Joseph leaned more toward the spiritual concept of the expected Messiah, but Mary and her family, especially her father, held to the idea of the Messiah as a temporal deliverer and political ruler. Mary's ancestors had been prominently identified with the Maccabean activities of the then but recent times. Joseph held vigorously to the Eastern or Babylonian views of the Jewish religion. Mary leaned strongly toward the more liberal and broader Western or Hellenistic interpretation of the law and the prophets. 6. The home of Nazareth. The home of Jesus was not far from the high hill in the northerly part of Nazareth, some distance from the village spring, which was in the eastern section of the town. Jesus' family dwelt in the outskirts of the city, and this made it all the easier for him subsequently to enjoy frequent strolls in the country and to make trips up to the top of this nearby highland, the highest of all the hills of southern Galilee, save the Mount Tabor range to the east and the hill of Nain, which was about the same height. Their home was located a little to the south and east of the southern promontory of this hill, and about midway between the base of this elevation and the road leading out of Nazareth toward Cana. Aside from climbing the hill, Jesus' favorite stroll was to follow a narrow trail winding about the base of the hill in a northeasterly direction to a point where it joined the road to Sepphoris. The home of Joseph and Mary was a one-room stone structure with a flat roof and an adjoining building for housing the animals. The furniture consisted of a low stone table, earthenware and stone dishes and pots, a loom, a lampstand, several small stools, and mats for sleeping on the stone floor. In the backyard, near the animal annex, was the shelter which covered the oven and the mill for grinding grain. It required two persons to operate this type of mill, one to grind and another to feed the grain. As a small boy, Jesus often fed grain to this mill while his mother turned the grinder. In later years, as the family grew in size, they would all squat about the enlarged stone table to enjoy their meals, helping themselves from a common dish or pot of food. During the winter, at the evening meal, the table would be lighted by a small, flat clay lamp, which was filled with olive oil. After the birth of Martha, Joseph built an addition to this house, a large room, which was used as a carpenter shop during the day and as a sleeping room at night. 7. The trip to Bethlehem. In the month of March, 8 BC, the month Joseph and Mary were married, Caesar Augustus decreed that all inhabitants of the Roman Empire should be numbered, that a census should be made which could be used for effecting better taxation. The Jews had always been greatly prejudiced against any attempt to number the people, and this, in connection with the serious domestic difficulties of Herod, king of Judea, had conspired to cause the postponement of the taking of this census in the Jewish kingdom for 1 year. Throughout all the Roman Empire, this census was registered in the year 8 BC, except in the Palestinian kingdom of Herod, where it was taken in 7 BC, 1 year later. It was not necessary that Mary should go to Bethlehem for enrollment. Joseph was authorized to register for his family, but Mary, being an adventurous and aggressive person, insisted on accompanying him. She feared being left alone lest the child be born while Joseph was away, and again, Bethlehem being not far from the city of Judah, Mary foresaw a possible pleasurable visit with her kinswoman Elizabeth. Joseph virtually forbade Mary to accompany him, but it was of no avail. When the food was packed for the trip of 3 or 4 days, she prepared double rations and made ready for the journey. But before they actually set forth, Joseph was reconciled to Mary's going along, and they cheerfully departed from Nazareth at the break of day. Joseph and Mary were poor, and since they had only one beast of burden, Mary, being large with the child, rode on the animal with the provisions while Joseph walked, leading the beast. The building and furnishing of a home had been a great drain on Joseph, since he had also to contribute to the support of his parents, as his father had been recently disabled. And so, this Jewish couple went forth from their humble home early on the morning of August 18, 7 BC, on their journey to Bethlehem. Their first day of travel carried them around the foothills of Mount Gilboa, where they camped for the night by the River Jordan, and engaged in many speculations as to what sort of a son would be born to them, Joseph adhering to the concept of a spiritual teacher, and Mary holding to the idea of a Jewish Messiah, a deliverer of the Hebrew nation. Bright and early the morning of August 19, Joseph and Mary were again on their way. They partook of their noontide meal at the foot of Mount Sartaba, overlooking the Jordan Valley, and journeyed on, making Jericho for the night, where they stopped at an inn on the highway in the outskirts of the city. Following the evening meal, and after much discussion concerning the oppressiveness of Roman rule, Herod, the census enrollment, and the comparative influence of Jerusalem and Alexandria as centers of Jewish learning and culture, the Nazareth travelers retired for the night's rest. Early in the morning of August 20, they resumed their journey, reaching Jerusalem before noon, visiting the temple, and going on to their destination, arriving at Bethlehem in mid-afternoon. The inn was overcrowded, and Joseph accordingly sought lodgings with distant relatives, but every room in Bethlehem was filled to overflowing. On returning to the courtyard of the inn, he was informed that the caravan stables, hewn out of the side of the rock and situated just below the inn, had been cleared of animals and cleaned up for the reception of lodgers. Leaving the donkey in the courtyard, Joseph shouldered their bags of clothing and provisions, and with Mary descended the stone steps to their lodgings below. They found themselves located in what had been a grain storage room to the front of the stalls and mangers. Tent curtains had been hung, and they counted themselves fortunate to have such comfortable quarters. Joseph had thought to go out at once and enroll, but Mary was weary. She was considerably distressed and besought him to remain by her side, which he did. 8. The Birth of Jesus. All that night Mary was restless, so that neither of them slept much. By the break of day the pangs of childbirth were well in evidence, and at noon, August 21, 7 B.C., with the help and kind ministrations of women fellow travelers, Mary was delivered of a male child. Jesus of Nazareth was born into the world, was wrapped in the clothes which Mary had brought along for just such a possible contingency, and laid in a nearby manger. In just the same manner as all babies before that day and since have come into the world, the promised child was born, and on the eighth day, according to the Jewish practice, he was circumcised and formally named Joshua, Jesus. The next day after the birth of Jesus, Joseph made his enrollment. Meeting a man they had talked with two nights previously at Jericho, Joseph was taken by him to a well-to-do friend who had a room at the inn, and who said he would gladly exchange quarters with the Nazareth couple. That afternoon they moved up to the inn, where they lived for almost 3 weeks until they found lodgings in the home of a distant relative of Joseph. The second day after the birth of Jesus, Mary sent word to Elizabeth that her child had come, and received word in return inviting Joseph up to Jerusalem to talk over all their affairs with Zacharias. The following week Joseph went to Jerusalem to confer with Zacharias. Both Zacharias and Elizabeth had become possessed with a sincere conviction that Jesus was indeed to become the Jewish deliverer, the Messiah, and that their son John was to be his chief of aides, his right-hand man of destiny. And since Mary held these same ideas, it was not difficult to prevail upon Joseph to remain in Bethlehem, the city of David, so that Jesus might grow up to become the successor of David on the throne of all Israel. Accordingly, they remained in Bethlehem more than a year, Joseph meantime working some at his carpenter's trade. At the noontide birth of Jesus, the seraphim of Urantia, assembled under their directors, did sing anthems of glory over the Bethlehem manger, but these utterances of praise were not heard by human ears. No shepherds nor any other mortal creatures came to pay homage to the babe of Bethlehem until the day of the arrival of certain priests from Ur, who were sent down from Jerusalem by Zacharias. These priests from Mesopotamia had been told some time before by a strange religious teacher of their country that he had had a dream in which he was informed that the light of life was about to appear on earth as a babe and among the Jews. And thither went these three teachers looking for this light of life. After many weeks of futile search in Jerusalem, they were about to return to Ur when Zacharias met them and disclosed his belief that Jesus was the object of their quest, and sent them on to Bethlehem, where they found the babe and left their gifts with Mary, his earth mother. The babe was almost 3 weeks old at the time of their visit. These wise men saw no star to guide them to Bethlehem. The beautiful legend of the Star of Bethlehem originated in this way. Jesus was born August 21 at noon, 7 B.C. On May 29, 7 B.C., there occurred an extraordinary conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in the constellation of Pisces. And it is a remarkable astronomic fact that similar conjunctions occurred on September 29 and December 5 of the same year. Upon the basis of these extraordinary but wholly natural events, the well-meaning zealots of the succeeding generation constructed the appealing legend of the Star of Bethlehem, and the adoring magi led thereby to the manger, where they beheld and worshipped the newborn babe. Oriental and near-Oriental minds delight in fairy stories, and they are continually spinning such beautiful myths about the lives of their religious leaders and political heroes. In the absence of printing, when most human knowledge was passed by word of mouth from one generation to another, it was very easy for myths to become traditions, and for traditions eventually to become accepted as facts. 9. The Presentation in the Temple. Moses had taught the Jews that every firstborn son belonged to the Lord, and that, in lieu of his sacrifice, as was the custom among the heathen nations, such a son might live provided his parents would redeem him by the payment of 5 shekels to any authorized priest. There was also a Mosaic ordinance which directed that a mother, after the passing of a certain period of time, should present herself, or have someone make the proper sacrifice for her, at the temple for purification. It was customary to perform both of these ceremonies at the same time. Accordingly, Joseph and Mary went to the temple at Jerusalem in person to present Jesus to the priests and effect his redemption, and also to make the proper sacrifice to ensure Mary's ceremonial purification from the alleged uncleanness of childbirth. There lingered constantly about the courts of the temple 2 remarkable characters, Simeon a singer and Anna a poetess. Simeon was a Judean, but Anna was a Galilean. This couple were frequently in each other's company, and both were intimates of the priest Zacharias, who had confided the secret of John and Jesus to them. Both Simeon and Anna longed for the coming of the Messiah, and their confidence in Zacharias led them to believe that Jesus was the expected deliverer of the Jewish people. Zacharias knew the day that Joseph and Mary were expected to appear at the temple with Jesus, and he had prearranged with Simeon and Anna to indicate, by the salute of his upraised hand, which one in the procession of firstborn children was Jesus. For this occasion, Anna had written a poem which Simeon proceeded to sing, much to the astonishment of Joseph, Mary, and all who were assembled in the temple courts. And this was their hymn of the redemption of the firstborn son. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, for he has visited us and wrought redemption for his people. He has raised up a horn of salvation for all of us in the house of his servant David. Even as he spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets, salvation from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show mercy to our fathers and remember his holy covenant, the oath which he swore to Abraham our father, to grant us that we, being delivered out of the hand of our enemies, should serve him without fear, in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. Yes, and you, child of promise, shall be called the prophet of the Most High. For you shall go before the face of the Lord to establish his kingdom, to give knowledge of salvation to his people in the remission of their sins. Rejoice in the tender mercy of our God, because the day spring from on high has now visited us, to shine upon those who sit in darkness and shadow of death, to guide our feet into ways of peace. And now let your servant depart in peace, O Lord, according to your word, for my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared before the face of all peoples, a light for even the unveiling of the Gentiles and the glory of your people Israel. On the way back to Bethlehem, Joseph and Mary were silent, confused, and overawed. Mary was much disturbed by the farewell salutation of Anna, the aged poetess, and Joseph was not in harmony with this premature effort to make Jesus out to be the expected Messiah of the Jewish people. 10. Herod Acts. But the watchers for Herod were not inactive. When they reported to him the visit of the priests of Ur to Bethlehem, Herod summoned these Chaldeans to appear before him. He inquired diligently of these wise men about the new king of the Jews, but they gave him little satisfaction, explaining that the babe had been born of a woman who had come down to Bethlehem with her husband for the census enrollment. Herod, not being satisfied with this answer, sent them forth with a purse and directed that they should find the child so that he too might come and worship him, since they had declared that his kingdom was to be spiritual, not temporal. But when the wise men did not return, Herod grew suspicious. As he turned these things over in his mind, his informers returned and made full report of the recent occurrences in the temple, bringing him a copy of parts of the Simeon song which had been sung at the redemption ceremonies of Jesus. But they had failed to follow Joseph and Mary, and Herod was very angry with them when they could not tell him whither the pair had taken the babe. He then dispatched searchers to locate Joseph and Mary. Knowing Herod pursued the Nazareth family, Zacharias and Elizabeth remained away from Bethlehem. The boy baby was secreted with Joseph's relatives. Joseph was afraid to seek work, and their small savings were rapidly disappearing. Even at the time of the purification ceremonies at the temple, Joseph deemed himself sufficiently poor to warrant his offering for Mary 2 young pigeons, as Moses had directed for the purification of mothers among the poor. When, after more than a year of searching, Herod's spies had not located Jesus, and because of the suspicion that the babe was still concealed in Bethlehem, he prepared an order directing that a systematic search be made of every house in Bethlehem, and that all boy babies under 2 years of age should be killed. In this manner, Herod hoped to make sure that this child who was to become king of the Jews would be destroyed. And thus perished in one day 16 boy babies in Bethlehem of Judea. But intrigue and murder, even in his own immediate family, were common occurrences at the court of Herod. The massacre of these infants took place about the middle of October 6 BC, when Jesus was a little over 1 year of age. But there were believers in the coming Messiah even among Herod's court attachés, and one of these, learning of the order to slaughter the Bethlehem boy babies, communicated with Zacharias, who in turn dispatched a messenger to Joseph. And the night before the massacre, Joseph and Mary departed from Bethlehem with the babe for Alexandria in Egypt. In order to avoid attracting attention, they journeyed alone to Egypt with Jesus. They went to Alexandria on funds provided by Zacharias, and there, Joseph worked at his trade while Mary and Jesus lodged with well-to-do relatives of Joseph's family. They sojourned in Alexandria 2 full years, not returning to Bethlehem until after the death of Herod.
So that ends paper 122.
Yes, and now we will go to the next paper, unless you have something to say to describe what we just heard.
Right, this is paper 123, the back to Nazareth. So let's play that recording.
Okay.
One, back in Nazareth. On the fourth day of the journey, the party reached its destination in safety. They arrived unannounced at the Nazareth home, which had been occupied for more than 3 years by one of Joseph's married brothers, who was indeed surprised to see them. So quietly had they gone about their business that neither the family of Joseph nor that of Mary knew that they had even left Alexandria. The next day, Joseph's brother moved his family, and Mary, for the first time since Jesus' birth, settled down with her little family to enjoy life in their own home. In less than a week, Joseph secured work as a carpenter, and they were supremely happy. Jesus was about 3 years and 2 months old at the time of their return to Nazareth. He had stood all these travels very well, and was in excellent health and full of childish glee and excitement at having premises of his own to run about in and to enjoy. But he greatly missed the association of his Alexandrian playmates. On the way to Nazareth, Joseph had persuaded Mary that it would be unwise to spread the word among their Galilean friends and relatives that Jesus was a child of promise. They agreed to refrain from all mention of these matters to anyone, and they were both very faithful in keeping this promise. Jesus' entire fourth year was a period of normal physical development and of unusual mental activity. Meantime, he had formed a very close attachment for a neighbor boy about his own age, named Jacob. Jesus and Jacob were always happy in their play, and they grew up to be great friends and loyal companions. The next important event in the life of this Nazareth family was the birth of the second child, James, in the early morning hours of April 2, 3 B.C., Jesus was thrilled by the thought of having a baby brother, and he would stand around by the hour just to observe the baby's early activities. It was midsummer of the same year that Joseph built a small workshop close to the village spring and near the caravan tarrying lot. After this, he did very little carpenter work by the day. He had as associates two of his brothers and several other mechanics whom he sent out to work while he remained at the shop making yokes and plows and doing other woodwork. He also did some work in leather, and with rope and canvas. And Jesus, as he grew up when not at school, spent his time about equally between helping his mother with home duties and watching his father work at the shop, meantime listening to the conversation and gossip of the caravan conductors and passengers from the four corners of the earth. In July of this year, 1 month before Jesus was 4 years old, an outbreak of malignant intestinal trouble spread all over Nazareth from contact with the caravan travelers. Mary became so alarmed by the danger of Jesus being exposed to this epidemic of disease that she bundled up both her children and fled to the country home of her brother, several miles south of Nazareth on the Megiddo Road near Sarid. They did not return to Nazareth for more than 2 months. Jesus greatly enjoyed this, his first experience on a farm.
And I believe that's it.
Right, right. What an incredible account we have just heard. It's as if we were actually there, witnessing the events as they unfolded. Hercules, how does this seem to you?
Well, a lot of it seemed familiar. The Greeks have writings called the Apocrypha that aren't in the standard Bibles outside of Greece, although they exist, in some of them exist in Catholic liturgies. So some of this information is contained in the Apocrypha.
So interesting.
There were some details that were new to me, but it's been many years since I read the Apocrypha, so I couldn't answer how much of this information is still in there.
Right, right. I'm just overwhelmed with the layers of information and details. The details in this are extraordinary. And every time I've listened to this recording, I learn new things. It's an amazing telling of this amazing story. Now, also, as you noticed, August 21 at 12 noon, 7 BC, is the actual date that the Urantia book says was the birth of Jesus. And modern scientists and researchers looking at this history and all the records that can be found have determined right now that they feel as though the actual birth of Jesus was in the late summer. And that's interesting because the Urantia book is saying August 21. So how interesting is that they would come up with late summer they felt was the actual birth date. I thought that was a really interesting thing that's going on. Also, you know, this description really gives you the feeling of what the people were like, their personalities, their dreams, their hopes, their backgrounds, in such subtle ways. Again, you feel as though you know them well. And that is such a gift that the Urantia book has always through the entire book. It's very detailed. And when I came across this book many, many years ago, a good 35 years ago, that just stuck out to me that it wasn't just general material. It was very specific facts. Very specific description. So I just marveled that we were being given that kind of information. And it's all through the book, of course. So the fourth part of the book, again, is the life and teachings of Jesus. And it's an extraordinary section, the fourth part of the book. The book is in four parts. To tell you the truth, the fourth part of the book is my personal favorite section. Because it's on such a level, and you can really empathize, you can understand with your own, our own experiences here in life, and how that relates to that time and those challenges that they faced. It was a turbulent time. I think you will agree with that. It was, you know, we have a very turbulent time going on right now. Politically, internationally, this was the same sort of thing. This was not a very peaceful time at all for Jesus to be born into.
No, it was a very turbulent time from all accounts.
And the fact that they were poor and that they had very little to live by and live with, very little. And It just tugs at your heart, the amount of love and preparation and caring that is all through this story. Joseph and Mary and their life together and the struggles that they face together, it just comes across as so human and so loving. I'm struck by the relationships, the other papers, of course, account for further on into the lives of Jesus, Mary and Joseph, the family, the friends, the apostles, and so forth. And again, you're getting a feeling of who these people really were and are, and what they're really like. It's an extraordinarily detailed accounting, and it absolutely sweeps you up into the telling of these stories of what it was like there.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that too?
Yeah, it was very well written, and it did. It was very immersive. It took you back into those times. I'm a student of ancient history, mostly Greek, but it was almost as if you were listening to somebody reporting on these events as they were happening.
That's a really good description, and I feel the same way. It's almost like looking and listening to a newscast of the actual mm-hmm. events. That's how it comes across.
Yeah.
And that's extraordinary. It's almost like if you had, say, a time machine and you were able to go back and see that and witness what was going on yourself. It feels like that.
Right.
Boy, would I love to have a time machine, wouldn't you?
I believe we all have time machines in our dreams and in our meditations. We can sometimes visit past locations.
Oh, that's interesting. Uh-huh. I can understand that. The one place I wouldn't want to go would be the crucifixion of Jesus. I don't think I literally could stand it.
Mm-hmm.
Really? I just don't think I never would want to witness something like that. It would be too much to handle. But all the stories of his interactions with the people of his time, from babies to young people to older people to incredibly old people at the time, and his interactions with them, and the loving details of what was said and done, also it sweeps you away into the story. And it's really an extraordinary book. The Arantia book is extraordinary. Anybody who's read this amazing book can tell you that their lives are affected in a wonderful way because of reading the Arantia book. It really gives you such a detailed perspective into mm-hmm. who we are of our time, of our birth in life and what we are going through. And it also, and this of course is extraordinary, what happens after we pass on from this planet? What is the structure that our universal lives take? Where we will be, what we're doing, and who we will meet? And it goes again into incredible detail on that amazing level. And again, for a lot of people who have lost very close, very dear, loving friends and relatives and partners, it's a very assuring account that death on this planet is not the end. It's only the beginning of what they call your universal career. That's the actual words they use, which talks about the fact that there is a huge amount ahead after we pass from this life to the next and beyond.
And that's very comforting to know.
It absolutely is. And on a personal level, of course, it's very difficult to lose anyone that you love when they pass on. It always is a challenge, for sure. And the Arantia book I recommend to people who are going through such a time in their own lives, because it really gives you great comfort that they are, I would say, heading en route to the center of all love, which is God, the Universal Father, and that their journey is towards that. And that gives you an amazing feeling of comfort, and certainly has in my own particular case for many, many years. I want to just say to the to our audience tonight that if they have any comments or questions, I would be very, very happy to take that information and to answer you. You can reach me directly by my email address, which I would like to give you right now. So that is NICKNYNY1, and that's the numeral 1, at gmail.com. Again, NICKNYNY1 at gmail.com, and all your comments or questions are most welcome. Hercules, how much time do we have left here? It's gone so quickly.
We have a couple of minutes. If you could let people know about, beyond the email, like where they might go to attend meetings in New York City and how often you have the meetings.
Right. Well, open to everyone in the area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. There is a wonderful organization that I've been a member of for many years called the Urantia Society of Greater New York. They have meetings every few months, and one of the highlights of those meetings is a worship service that is given at the beginning of the meeting by one of the members. And the members are asked if they would prepare and produce a worship service according to what they feel is appropriate. So you might get a worship service that includes music. It could be classic. It could be gospel. It could be country. It could be something symphonic. And then whatever else the person who is celebrating the service feels is appropriate. It might be readings from the Rancher book. Sometimes it's readings from other material. And it's always a high point. And then after that, they have a 90-minute program that one of the members will present on a portion of the Urantia book. So it's a very beautiful meeting that we have, and people are welcome to inquire about that. Now, lately, they have now put it as a Zoom meeting, which means that people can access that from anywhere in the world. So that is, again, it's an incredible innovation to be able to do that. It's very recent. And so I can give you that information, too, if you'd be interested in seeing and hearing what one of our meetings is like. So with that note, I will end this now by saying this is Nick Curto for the Urantia book, wishing you all an enlightened journey. Till next time, please explore the deep wisdom and limitless love contained in the Urantia book. Stay safe and be very, very kind to one another. A very happy holiday to everyone everywhere. With much love to our listeners out there. Till next time, this is Nick Curto wishing you all a safe and warm good evening.
Thank you, Nick, and thanks to all our listeners, be they present at the time of recording or checking us out later on demand. Until next time, joyous journeys, amazing adventures, and happy and healthy holidays. Good night, everybody.
Good night.